and welcome to The Rest Is Money with me, Steph McGovern.
And with me, Robert Peston.
Well, we've had quite the week with our mini-series, haven't we, on Liz Truss.
Who killed Liz Truss?
Yeah.
The crime of the century.
I tell you what's cracked me up, though, since our little mini-series came out, is you actually saw Liz Truss, didn't you? And she gave you a copy of her book, and in it, she has handwritten a note to you which says, "To Robert, we know who killed Liz Truss!" Exclamation mark, signed Liz Truss. "No" in capital letters, I'd like to point out as well, which is very funny.
Yeah, that was... one for the bookshelf.
Well, there we are. And thank you as well, everyone who's been sending us in lots of comments and thoughts on it. You can send us more if you want. You can email us, restismoney@gmail.com, or you can send them through our socials as well, and any suggestions of anything else you want us to deep dive on.
And I think it is going to reverberate. I mean, I was, you know, literally within minutes of the thing going live, the podcast, I got rung up by a member of the cabinet who is not somebody who would remotely be seen as a Liz Truss supporter, who basically said, yeah, we were all very let down, you know, not only by the Bank of England, but by Whitehall. So this story about the failure of the establishment, if like us, you think that on this occasion, the civil service has been incompetent rather than malevolent, that it's still an issue. You know, we need competent Whitehall, we need a competent Bank of England. And I think our view would be there hasn't been a proper investigation of how Whitehall and the Bank of England let down elected ministers.
Who was it who called you?
I'll tell you afterwards.
Okie dokie. So today, though, we've got some more topics for you. We're going to talk about tax avoidance for a start, tax evasion, basically tax dodgers, because Rachel Reeves has brought out a plan to try and tackle it in the hope of clawing back some money from the people who she thinks are not paying enough in tax. And after the break, we're going to talk about what's going on in retail. And in particular, I'm quite interested in what's happening with Lidl and Aldi and the supermarket scene at the moment, and this rapid expansion Aldi and Lidl have, but how, you know, that's kind of stalling a bit now and what's going on there. So that's our topics for today. And starting with tax avoidance, this is not because you've got a confession or anything to make about tax avoidance, is it, Robert?
Actually, I have always been unbelievably boring when it comes to tax, because I take the view, if you do my kind of job,
yeah,
you know, whether you're, you know, a political editor or economics editor or a business editor, the last thing you want is publicity saying that you're playing fast and loose with tax. So I'm incredibly neurotic about making sure I always fill in my tax form on time, pay every conceivable amount of tax that I could possibly, you know, and so I've never engaged in any of these schemes.
No, I'm kidding, I haven't. I'm the same, because you just know you need to be whiter than white, don't you, if you're doing our job. But there's a reason in particular we're talking about it today, because Rachel Reeves has basically got this plan, hasn't she, to tackle tax dodgers and kind of bring in some money from this so-called tax gap. And she's announced a couple of things around what she would do. First of all, it's, you know, increasing the number of compliance officers. So those, these people who are looking into it, up to about 5,000 people, and, you know, basically getting people, more people to actually work on trying to solve this. Also digitization, she reckons that might be able to help, investing in that area to kind of improve how they deal with complex compliance cases. And then stuff around working with businesses to learn from the industry and set up best practice. But there's a reason why she's doing this, isn't this? This is because she needs the money now. She actually needs to crack down on these people who aren't paying tax, because the Tories have already announced some of the things she was going to do.
You know, this is a response to Jeremy Hunt nicking one of her ideas to raise money, which was to make so-called non-DOMs, those are basically overseas people who move here, pay proper tax in the UK. And he announced in the last budget that much of what Labour wanted to do, which was to get these non-DOMs to pay tax, non-DOMs like the Prime Minister's wife. And that created a problem for her, because that was £2 billion of money that she needed for her three of Labour's ambitions. One is to reduce waiting lists in the NHS, another is to give more dental appointments, and the other is to provide these breakfast clubs in schools. These are very important Labour policies. Labour's position, Rachel Reeves's position, is that they will not borrow to finance these sorts of initiatives, that every initiative of this sort in the run-up to the election that they're promising people would be paid for by tax, but he nicked the tax that she needed for these initiatives. And therefore, since the mini budget, she has been under pressure to come up with the money from somewhere else. Now, what she's announced is that they will give something of the order of 500 million quid to HMRC, the tax man, and she believes that over the 5 years of the next parliament, that will lead to £5 billion per year of additional tax raised by the tax man. And so she would argue this more than covers the needs that they have for these promises to voters. But, you know, whenever I've seen over many, many years politicians announce that they're simply going to give money to HMRC to get better at collecting tax, I've always had a sort of slightly cynical view in my mind that this is too easy. You know, politicians hate putting taxes up for all of us because they think that's politically unpopular. But they think that when they announce that they're simply going to get the tax man to collect the taxes that are due, that's somehow not politically quite so risky. And so the question is always, is it real? If you give 500 million to HMRC, is HMRC actually going to raise that tax? That is one of the issues.
Well, let's break it down what we're talking about here. So as things stand, there's currently around a £36 billion tax gap in Britain. So that's basically between what is owed and what is actually paid. That works out at just under 5% of the tax. So basically, HMRC collect just over 95% of all the tax due, and there's this 5% left, which is 36 billion quid's worth. And the reason there is that gap, it's because of a mix of things. So for some, it's just the complication of doing their taxes, the fact they make mistakes from it. And then you've got the kind of grey area of tax avoidance and the very illegal area of tax evasion.
Yeah, and I think it is important just to understand this decision between evasion and avoidance. If you are evading taxes, you are making a conscious decision to break the law. You are not paying the tax that you know you owe. Avoidance is a bit more subtle than that. There are all these professional firms that make money out of devising schemes that do not, frankly, accord with the spirit of tax law, but they are a way of exploiting loopholes. And quite often, avoidance turns out to be illegal, but people who use avoidance schemes usually think that they're not breaking the law. Sometimes they find out, to their very great cost, that they have broken the law, and they end up paying vast amounts of money, and in some cases face criminal charges. Not always, but evasion is the one that is sort of straightforwardly a breach of the law.
Do you remember, though, I think it was about 10 years ago when loads of celebs ended up in the papers over their tax affairs. And it was all to do with this scheme where basically the allegation was that it helped them reduce how much tax they had to pay. And it was called K2. And let me explain the basis of it. So basically, this K2 scheme involved this offshore shell company, offshored in Jersey. And so the celeb or whoever it was, the person who was, you know, trying to reduce their tax liabilities, and apparently it was about over 1,000 people who used this particular scheme, would be hired as a worker by this offshore shell company. And then what they would do, this company, is then hire the person out to work in the UK, but they would pay them on a low salary, so less than what they'd be normally paying if they'd have just done it directly with whoever they're working for in the UK. But then they'd also, to compensate for that, get loans of thousands of pounds a month, which could be written down as tax liabilities, therefore reducing the amount of tax they paid. So now this apparently was not illegal the way they'd done it, but obviously it's definitely dodgy, isn't it? And there was lots of controversy around that, and, you know, the celebs all over the papers because of it.
There's a really interesting sort of ethical issue here. I mean, you know, my own view, I'm going to sound appallingly self-righteous, but my own view is that if you take advantage of public services in a country, you do have an obligation to pay your taxes. And if something smells like a sort of dodgy attempt to get around paying your taxes, personally, I take the view that you shouldn't do it. Now, there is a sort of grey area. You'll remember that when you and I worked for the BBC, both of us were just straightforward employees of the BBC. But quite a lot of our colleagues had these personal service companies, which were a deliberate vehicle scheme to reduce the tax that they paid. But the reason I say it's a grey area is because quite a lot of those people who were hired by the BBC on that basis say, and I think I have every reason to believe they are right, that they were encouraged by the BBC to be employed in this way. I think if your employer is saying to you, do this, then I think, you know, it's quite hard to be critical if that is the route you take.
Well, interestingly, this happened to me where I was encouraged when I left my staff contract at the BBC and kind of went freelance. I was really encouraged to set up this kind of personal service company and then build through that with, as you say, a view to it reducing your tax liability. And then it all came to a head, didn't it? Because this whole IR35 legislation came out, which is basically the problem was people were working as disguised employees. So they were meant to be just contractors. So, you know, you would be contracted to present a show or whatever. But if you were doing it as a full-time job, you're not really a contractor, are you? You become an employee, but you're a disguised employee and you're paying less tax than you should be. So this Inland Revenue brought out this IR35. I was trying to work out where the name came from, and it's just actually the legislation itself has got nothing to do with IR35. That just happened to be the press release name when they sent out that they were doing this legislation. But the big case was obviously like Lorraine Kelly, do you remember? So she was taken to court saying that she owed loads of money in tax because she'd ran herself through this personal service company. But her argument was that she wasn't an employee being employed by ITV. She was actually a brand. So her service company were providing a product to ITV, not a person. So therefore, she wasn't an employee. And she won the case. I mean, that case was worth, it was over £1 million. So it gets really complicated, doesn't it? And it could end up costing them more money, the HMRC, if they're then taking people to court over these compliance cases. And there was another element to this as well, not just the people in TV land who earn loads of money, but for genuine contractors who are now put off by the complexities of the IR35 rules. So there was some research which was done by the Association of Independent Professionals and the Self-Employed, catchy title, which said that 1 in 10 contractors say they're now not working because of tax reforms, and in particular this IR35, because it's just not worth it for them. So that's the danger.
I mean, actually, this takes us back to Liz Truss, because you probably remember in the mini budget, there was quite a big chunk about actually reforming IR35 and, you know, actually allowing more people to use it, weirdly. Anyway, one, I think, quite important point, which we talked about earlier, was if you give HMRC this kind of money, does it actually lead to more tax being raised? I have to say, talking to experts in this field, I talked to this bloke, Dan Needle, for example.
We need to get him on. You've given him a couple of shout-outs now.
Yeah, I think he probably will come on. He's a very interesting bloke anyway. He's a former tax lawyer who now has a sort of campaigning research organisation about getting people to pay the tax that they owe. You know, he makes some really quite interesting points about how this is genuinely just a very efficient route to raise money. I mean, it is the case that the HMRC has simply not had enough people on staff to do things, this is what Dan says, you know, like simply look at social media, Facebook, those sorts of platforms where there are schemes to dodge tax, to avoid tax, that are advertised, are marketed at people. And he says most of these schemes should not be allowed to exist. They take a load of money from people in terms of fees, and many of these people end up then having to pay enormous amounts of tax. You know, when the HMRC eventually catches up with them, people end up much poorer. And he says all that HMRC really ought to do is just, you know, hire a bunch of bright young people to scour social media and you'd be able to shut down a whole bunch of tax avoidance schemes. And then the other thing is, have you tried to get through to HMRC on the phone? It is a nightmare at the moment, right? They don't pick up. How can you be sure you're going to pay the right tax if you cannot get the answer either on the phone or these days? And one of the things that Reeves is doing is she's giving them more money to digitize their services, right? You do raise an enormous amount more tax if people know the tax that they have to pay.
Yeah, I mean, we had that question, didn't we, a few weeks ago about understanding tax codes as well. So, you know, there's so much complication to it. You think AI would be able to help though, don't you? This is
what
where...
AI can help, but they can't invest in AI unless they got the money. So yeah. I do think that the kind of things that Reeves is talking about almost certainly will end up generating the kind of money that she says she's going to get. But I would say one thing. She looked at some evidence that the head of HMRC gave to MPs that basically you raise £9 in extra tax for every additional pound you give HMRC. Right. So at that point, you'd say it's a no-brainer. Why not give HMRC unlimited amounts of money if they're going to raise all this additional tax? I mean, the answer is some of that tax gap you can't ever close just through inefficiencies. And secondly, there are always diminishing returns. So it might be that you would get £9 raised for £1 now. But the more money you give to HMRC, the harder it gets to get. So whether she'll actually end up getting the 5 billion, I'm not sure. I am confident she'll get the 5 billion over 5 years, but she'll get something and she'll get more than she invests in HMRC.
I was looking at what that tax gap has been over the last kind of 20, 30 years. And actually it has been coming down. So for example, like in 2013, that tax gap, which I said earlier is now at about 4.8%, was 7% then. So in 10 years, it has been slowly coming down. But I wonder if there's a point where you just can't reduce it anymore.
I mean, talking about diminishing returns, I mean, we've now heard that Manchester Police are, you know, many officers looking at the tax that Angela Rayner may or may not owe on her council house sale. That's quite a lot of money being invested by Manchester Police. Is that an effective use of money in your view?
Well, I suppose it's because Angela Rayner's got to have, you know, be accountable for it, hasn't she? But I'd like to think that we do that for everyone who might potentially owe more tax than they've paid. But it is dead complicated.
I just don't know how many people would know that if you are a married couple, even if you own separate properties, which she and her husband in those days did. I don't know how many people would know that, you know, once you're married, the couple can only save capital gains tax on one property. Because normally people think they have independent taxation if you're married. That was one of the big changes that, you know, came in over the last 20 years. First of all, we don't know, because she won't tell us precisely what tax advice she got. We don't know whether her husband, for example, paid CGT on his capital gains tax on his property. What we do know, which is just a fact, is that one of them should have paid capital gains tax. Mm. But again, Dan Needle did some work on this. I mean, I think he worked out that at most it would be not much more than a grand. So if you think about that, you know, potential grand that she may or may not owe, I mean, obviously it's trivial compared to the sums of money that HMRC were saying that Nadeem Zahawi, when he was Chancellor, might have owed them through his own approach to reducing his tax liability. I mean, obviously, we don't want any of our elected politicians, you know, either to bend the tax rules or to be incompetent, as it were. But I think we've just got to wait and hear precisely what happened in the Angela Rayner case. And one of the things that I am slightly surprised by, and maybe slightly disappointed by, is she hasn't yet given us the detail.
Right. I think it's time for a break.
Welcome back to The Rest Is Money with me, Robert Peston.
And me, Steph McGovern. We're going to talk supermarkets now. This is like one of my obsession areas. I love going into a supermarket, and especially, you know, I was in a Lidl when I was in Portugal recently, and I love comparing them and all of that. But the reason it got me thinking about Lidl, because, and there's a particular reason I want to talk about it in terms of what's going on for them at the minute. But bit of a backstory for you. The Lidl and Aldi takeover of the supermarket scene in the UK kind of started in the 90s. They are both privately owned businesses, which is really important to all of this. And they've got a business model that hasn't really changed. So their shops are smaller than traditional supermarkets. They sell a lot of their own label stuff. They have a limited range. So they have something like 2,000 products compared to tens of thousands that you'd get in Tesco. They've got fewer staff. Even things like their shelves are designed so that things are in cardboard boxes with their products in. So restocking is much simpler and quicker. And so they hit the scene in the 90s, have been rapidly expanding in that time. Combined, they've got, I think it's something like 18% of the grocery market, which is obviously nowhere near still Tesco's dominance of over 27%. But they've certainly been chipping away at the supermarkets. For example, Aldi is now bigger than Morrison's in terms of market share.
And it's really important to say that in terms of value for money, they've driven really important price competition.
Yeah, they have. But they've also got more bougie. Have you noticed that now? So for example, you can get good wine in your Aldis and Lidls.
And organic food.
Yeah, and like seafood. And the middle aisle in a Lidl or Aldi is just, you go in there for some, I don't know, a tin of tuna and some bits and bobs, and you come out with a pair of skis. That's the kind of level we're talking to. That doesn't happen to me in Tesco or Sainsbury's, but it happens to me in Lidl and Aldi. So they've gone to a really clever thing here. But there's an interesting story here in terms of the expansion. So they've both been opening loads of stores, but things have started to slow now. And Lidl in particular has been stung by the fact that they've borrowed heavily to finance this expansion. Aldi, on the other hand, have been using the family money, the family business.
They're both family controlled though, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. But Lidl have been, the family's been less generous with the money and for investment. They've got themselves into quite a lot of debt.
Can I ask you just on that question? Do you think the fact they're family controlled is important?
I think it's the reason why they've done so well, in the sense of
they take the long view, they're not subject to shareholder pressure, and therefore they can invest in price in a way that, you know, whether it's a publicly owned business like Tesco or perhaps private equity owned like Asda.
Yeah. And, you know, they haven't got that when private equity come in, they normally do a bit of asset stripping and all that. I think there's just more, like you say, a much longer term commitment. So, for example, something like the pandemic, they can ride through that because there's enough family money to cover it and they're less stressed. But the problem now is Lidl have got themselves into such a lot of debt because of the fact interest rates have gone up so much. So even though...
But they're not in trouble then.
No, they're not in trouble, but they were taking something like £41 million in profit last year, which became a £76 million loss because the interest on the debt has tripled in that time. So their expansion is now slowed. They've pulled plans to open a new warehouse and they're not as expanding as quickly as they were.
So there was a bit of a, you know, we've got a neighbourhood WhatsApp group and there was a lot of moaning about the fact that our local Lidl had just closed. Are they closing shops as well?
Yeah, they are closing some of them. I still think in total they are increasing, but it's not the kind of juggernaut that it had been. You know, people, lots of analysts in that sector were talking about between them hitting 25% market share in the next few years, but that's looking less likely. And now the talk is, have they reached their peak? Is them combined having 18%, that's as high as they're going to get? And they're never going to beat Tesco. Although there's an interesting guy who was an exec at Aldi, and he was saying Aldi is now kind of buzzing at the fact that they haven't built all of their expansion on debt. So they're now just going to watch, they think they're just going to watch Lidl kind of slowly slip away while they run up the sidetrack and take over. Because Lidl's got their debt, they've got something like £2.3 billion due for repayment in the next 5 years, which is a lot of money. And I don't think they'd counted on, you know, the fact that interest rates were going to increase so much and their debt was going to increase. The other thing about I find fascinating about the discounters, as we call them, although I don't think discount is the right word for them anymore, they've always been behind on the whole loyalty cards, apps, the IT systems. They've never really pumped a lot of money into that. And now they're looking at doing that. So I wonder if they're going to become much more like the other supermarkets.
But the price differential is still amazing. I mean, I just, you know, I happened to go into an Aldi the other day. Unlike you, I hate going into supermarkets, if I'm honest with you. But I had to go into the Aldi. And actually, I have to say, this is not supposed to be an advert for Aldi. I couldn't believe how cheap it was.
Yeah.
I mean, it is pretty jaw-dropping, the price differential.
But you normally shop in Fortnum and Mason for your food, though, so I'm imagining you would see quite a big difference. I'm taking the mick.
You definitely are taking the mick, I have to say. I don't think I've been in at Fortnum and Mason since I was about 12, but anyway.
But what I'm also interested in all of this is, obviously, so Aldi and Lidl doing all this, then at the same time, you've got, for example, Asda and Morrisons, who are currently selling off quite a lot of their property. Well, not a lot, but are selling off some of their properties to try and raise money to pay off their debts. So they're doing the lease back, basically. So they're selling the property that they own and then leasing it back to continue running it as a store. So this whole issue with debt, and we've talked about it before, is a big problem for retailers, I think, particularly those who, when money was cheap, really went on big expansion plans. And you've got to ask yourself, is that the Bank of England's fault? You know, who killed Liz Truss? Who might kill some of the retailers?
Yeah, everything comes back to Liz Truss, obviously, in our world.
I think you've got a bit of a crush on Liz Truss. Am I allowed to say that publicly?
No, you're not. First of all, you've accused me of being Richie Rich, who basically spends all their time in Fortnum's and Masons. Now you're making a really weird charge. Anyway, look, I have to say, if we are on her, her resilience is astonishing. I mean, most people would be hiding under a rock forever after what she went through. And the fact that she's just out there saying, I didn't do anything wrong and this is my plan to save the West is sort of remarkable. So there are two or three other things on this that obviously seem to me to be sort of worth thinking about. One is, when you talk to retailers in this country, they say, fantastic, we got all this competition. It means basket of food in this country is cheaper than elsewhere. Actually, I looked at international comparisons recently, and it is true that a basket of food in France is a bit more expensive than in the UK. But actually, if you look at most other competitive countries in the, you know, around Europe, actually food is not particularly cheaper here than it is elsewhere. And some people would argue, and I might argue this actually, that the basket of food that you get in France, even though it's a bit more expensive, I mean, first of all, on the whole, they have higher wages than we have here, and B, the quality of what you get in a French supermarket is pretty good. If you talk to farmers in this country, they would argue that UK supermarkets abuse their market power, which means that they as farmers can't invest enough in producing quality produce. And I think that is a debate that we don't have enough. One of the things we definitely discovered from what happened to food prices after Putin invaded Ukraine is food security is an important thing, right? And so you do want investment in your indigenous food industry. And, you know, there is an interesting debate to be had about whether we are investing enough in our own agriculture and whether or not there are arguments for saying if the higher price gets passed back to farmers, there's a good thing.
I remember when I was doing some work in an investigations, a documentary about some of the suppliers and the kind of hell they're put through because of supermarkets. And I think it has changed quite a bit. There was, you know, quite a lot of work done on this. But there was one dairy farmer in particular who was saying to me that they'd have an order from a supermarket, and this would be, you know, make or break size orders. But then on the Friday before, I don't know, the order's meant to be delivered out on the one part of it's meant to go out on the Saturday, they'd get a call from someone in the supermarket who'd try and negotiate down the price again. And it just sounded so awful, because if they don't then agree to this new negotiated price, they might cancel the order and all the product's already there, and then where are you left? So, and I do, like I say, I think things have got a bit better on that front. But when we as shoppers look for the best price, we very rarely think about what that price pressure is putting on, you know, the people who actually make these products and provide the stuff for us. That's a very worthy ending to all of this.
Well, we're not going to quite end there, because we are talking to Sharon White.
Yes.
And she's pretty much at the other end of the supermarket market, as it were, from Lidl and Aldi, because she's the chair, she's the boss of John Lewis, who own Waitrose, which, you know, is, I have to say, you accuse me of shopping in Fortnum and Masons. I do occasionally shop in Waitrose, which is definitely would be regarded as a higher price point than Aldi and Lidl. But I want to say, I love Aldi, Lidl, Waitrose, all of them.
Excellent. Well, that is good to hear, even though you don't rarely go in them.
And the point about the Sharon White interview, which is you can listen to on Monday, is she is somebody who's been at the top of the Treasury. She ran the media regulator Ofcom. She's taken John Lewis through its the most difficult period, some would say, in its entire history because of the impact of COVID, because of the impact of online retailing on their department stores. So it's a gripping interview.
Yeah. It's one to look forward to. That'll be out on Monday. But that's it from us. If you want to send us in any questions, we'll be doing another questions episode soon, I'm sure. You can email us, restismoney@gmail.com, or use our social medias, Rest Is Money, and you'll find us. But that's it from us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.